welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles. There's a special feeling we get when we pick up a new book by a favorite author. Of course, we expect a great story to unfold, but we also anticipate something akin to quality time with a good friend. Lately, TV binge-watching on Netflix or on-demand is a thing, isn't it? I'm certain many of us are guilty of binge reading. We discover a book by a great writer, race through it, and we're off to the next. Today, I've researched the bestseller list and found new titles from favorite authors. My guest, Clive Cussler, perfectly illustrates my theory. We'll speak with him about his new Isaac Bell thriller, The Assassin. The legends return, and we're glad of it. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. Neil Gaiman returns to haunt and entertain in his third story collection, Trigger Warning, Short Fictions and Disturbances. In this new anthology, Gaiman, who performs the book, pierces the veil of reality to reveal the shadowy world that lies beneath. Fans are treated to a special Doctor Who story written for the 50th anniversary of the series in 2013, as well as Black Dog, a new tale that revisits the world of American gods, exclusive to this collection. Also included are Adventure Story, a thematic companion to The Ocean at the End of the Lane, and Gaiman's own spin on Sherlock Holmes in his award-nominated mystery tale, The Case of Death and Honey.
What we read as adults should be read, I think, with no warnings or alerts beyond perhaps enter at your own risk. We need to find out what fiction is, what it means to us, an experience that is going to be unlike anyone else's experience of the story. We build the stories in our heads. We take words and we give them power and we look out through other eyes and we see and experience what others see. I wonder, are fictions safe places? And then I ask myself, should they be safe places? There are stories I read as a child I wished once I'd read them that I'd never encountered because I was not ready for them and they upset me. Stories which contained helplessness, in which people were embarrassed or mutilated, in which adults were made vulnerable and parents could be of no assistance. They troubled me and haunted my nightmares and my daydreams, worried and upset me on profound levels. But they also taught me that if I was going to read fiction, sometimes I would only know what my comfort zone was by leaving it. And now, as an adult, I would not erase the experience of having read them if I could. There are still things that profoundly upset me when I encounter them, whether it's on the web or the word or in the world. They never get easier, never stop my heart from trip-trapping, never let me escape, this time unscathed. But they teach me things, and they open my eyes. And if they hurt, they hurt in ways that make me think and grow and change. I wondered, reading about the college discussions, whether one day people would put a trigger warning on my fiction. I wondered whether or not they would be justified in doing it. And then I decided to do it first. There are things in this book, as in life, that might upset you. There is death and pain in here, tears and discomfort, violence of all kinds, cruelty, even abuse. There's kindness too, I hope, sometimes. Even a handful of happy endings. Few stories end unhappily for all participants, after all. And there's more than that. I know a lady called Rocky who is triggered by tentacles, and who genuinely needs warnings for things that have tentacles in them, especially tentacles with suckers, and who, confronted with an unexpected squid or octopus, will dive shaking behind the nearest sofa. There is an enormous tentacle somewhere in these pages. Many of these stories end badly for at least one of the people in them. Consider yourself warned. 2. Pre-flight safety demonstration. Sometimes huge truths are uttered in unusual contexts. I fly too much, a concept in a sentence that would have been impossible for me to understand as a young man when every plane journey was exciting and miraculous, when I would stare out of the window at the clouds below and imagine that they were a city or a world, somewhere I could walk safely. Still, I find myself, at the start of each flight, meditating and pondering the wisdom offered by the flight attendants, as if it were a koan, or a tiny parable, or the high point of all wisdom. This is what they say. Secure your own mask before helping others. And I think of us, all the people, and the masks we wear, the masks we hide behind, and the masks that reveal. I imagine people pretending to be what they truly are and discovering that other people are so much more and so much less than they imagined themselves to be or present themselves as. And then I think about the need to help others and how we mask ourselves to do it and how unmasking makes us vulnerable. We are all wearing masks. That is what makes us interesting. These are stories about those masks and the people we are underneath them. We authors, who trade in fictions for a living, are a continuum of all that we have seen and heard, and most importantly, all that we have read.
We've just heard Trigger Warning by Neil Gaiman. The legendary author Clive Cussler has kept fans turning pages for more than 40 years. Clive grew up in California and attended Pasadena City College. At the outbreak of the Korean War, Clive enlisted in the Air Force and served as an aircraft mechanic, then flight engineer in the Military Air Transport Service. Once discharged, he became a copywriter and worked his way up to be creative director at two leading ad agencies. He began writing novels in 1965 and published his first Dirk Pitt novel in 1973. Cussler's breakout Raise the Titanic firmly established Dirk Pitt as one of the leading men in adventure fiction. Clive is the founder of the National Underwater and Marine Agency, NUMA, a nonprofit organization dedicated to American maritime and naval history. Among the 75 wrecks found, NUMA's most notable discovery may be the H.L. Hunley, an 1864 Confederate submarine best known as the first sub to sink a ship in battle. It was found buried in Charleston Harbor in 1995 and is still undergoing restoration. His best-selling nonfiction books, The Sea Hunters and The Sea Hunters 2, describe the true adventures of the real NUMA. Clive is also a noted collector of classic cars and owns more than 100 vehicles. The collection is housed in a museum near Golden, Colorado. Clive now splits his time between Colorado and Arizona. Today we'll speak with Clive about his new title, The Assassin. Welcome, Clive, and it's such a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
For those who haven't met him yet, can you introduce us to Isaac Bell?
I introduce you to Isaac Bell. Well, he's a little different than, most of your detectives are usually from New York or whatever, plus their present day, where Isaac Bell is, he's of a detective agency like the Pinkertons, only it's called the Van Dorns. And his time era is anywhere from 1895 up to 1919. So it's fun to work with him in that era because you can describe old cars, old motorcycles, how the ladies are dressed with a Gibson girl look. And it's just great fun to set a different setting.
Why did you decide to take on John D. Rockefeller in Standard Oil in The Assassin?
Well, Justin Scott and I, who I work with, decided to take with him in his time zone there, eras. In other words, we go in where there's the big problem were with the coal strikes, and then the next book would be where the Mississippi River, all the trains and the ferry boats, and how the big train moguls are fighting over, lines where they go. And, that kind of a situation, like even Prohibition, we touched on that. And so it's fun to take, a background of that era, which was big news then, and then work it into a book with detectives, villains, and so much adventure and excitement.
What kind of research did you do to write convincingly about the oil fields in Baku, Russia in 1905?
Well, you can. It's there. It's a question of, you know, just digging into it, finding the old newspapers even and the old records you know, what you can find out. And of course, the internet now, there's just about anything you can find, where the old days, you know, had to go to a library. So it's there. It's just, you know, if you want to look for it, you can find all sorts of things, you know, lost mysteries, lost civilizations, you know, whatever. So it's just a great fun when you get into really reading about it, things you don't know.
Can you describe your writing process with Justin Scott? How does it work?
Justin and I will get together, and then we have to come up with a plot. So, you know, and most good, you know, mysteries, adventures, you know, it's just a very simple basis. It's what if. So, you know, what if, you know, this the oil situation and this assassin's killing all the oil men there, shooting them. So we go from there, and so then he'll go off and he'll write, and I'll still research and note, and then we'll get together on the first 100 pages and firm those up. And then he goes off, you know, and starts the second 100, and I still do some of the research for it. And then I'll come out and I maybe rewrite some or, you know, edit when the book is finished, manuscript, and send it into the publisher.
You've written books with your son, Dirk, also. How is that process?
That's the same thing. Dirk was funny. He got an MBA at UCLA and then got a job as a financial analyst at Motorola for 13 years. And he just got tired. He couldn't do it anymore. But he didn't know what he wanted to do. And I said, why don't you write a Dirk Pitt book? Oh, my God. I can't do that. And I said, you've read them all. And I said, I'll help you write it, you know. So he did, and he did a very nice job. And he's done, I think, four books since.
You'd have to believe that Dirk was in his DNA, right? Can you tell us a bit about NUMA and how you became interested in underwater exploration?
Oh, it all started when I was in the service back in the 50s and flying transport planes back and forth between Tokyo and during the Korean situation. And so when I'd stop in Hawaii, I'd go, first of all, surfing, and then I'd go snorkeling, and a buddy of mine and I, we thought, gosh, this is, let's get to that new, you know, regulator and tank that this guy in France, Cousteau, came out with. So we sent a check for $35 for a tank and a regulator, which is what it all only cost in those days. And then it took 3 months and it finally came, and we just took it out to the base, to a hangar, and filled it up, the tank, with some old air, stale air, and a compressor. And then we ran out into the ocean. Fortunately, we didn't go beyond 30 feet because there was no instruction or anything. We just put it on and breathed. So that's how it all started. And I got interested in photography and spearfishing and all that. And then I found an old Hawaiian and a trawler off of Hawaii, and that just, you know, you see a shipwreck on the bottom and you're just thrilled by it. So when I could afford it, then I started, you know, funding expeditions to go out and look for historic shipwrecks. People would think I belong in a rubber room under restraint because I never look for treasure.
We're speaking with Clive Cussler on the Book Report.
And how did you get into vintage automobile collecting?
Well, that started in high school, I think. I had a big black Auburn limousine, and my buddies and I paid, I think, $20 for it in those days. And my buddies and I, we'd dress up as gangsters with overcoats, fedoras, smoking cigars. And I played the violin when I was a little kid. And so, but that ended, and it was up, the violin was up in the garage, so I pulled it down and got the case. And when we go to the football games in my big limo dressed as gangsters, the guards at the gate never knew that I had the violin case filled with beer and wine.
That's funny. Do you converse regularly with other vintage car collectors like Jay Leno?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen Jay's collection. It's just incredible what he's put together. I remember one time we both had 36 cars. Now I've only got 137. He's got about 300.
Wow.
So, but he's got quite a collection. It's a marvelous. But it's not generally open to the public.
Yeah. Well, yours is in a museum that is open to the public, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Ma'am.
My daughter. I just stored them like he's doing, and then my daughter said, why don't we turn it into a museum? And I said, fine. So she took it over and has done a wonderful job.
Mm.
It's got a good reputation for tourists.
Well, back to the writing. What projects are you working on now?
Starting another one, I'm working on the Fargos. That one's coming up. This is one of the few husband and wife teams, in this case they go around and look for treasure. But the fun part with them is it's kind of like a Thin Man series, you know, the two of them together. They're well off, and they always get involved in searching for treasure and get into all kinds of trouble. And so they're fun to work with. And then there's the Oregon Files, which is this old beat-up tramp steamer, you know, that flies around the world. And it's like a Mission Impossible. The mercenaries on board this old ship that looks like it's ready to sink, but actually inside it's has these huge engines that can pump it out at 50 miles an hour.
Hmm.
And all this armament on board, and the mercenaries, you know, where the ship isn't look like an old dump, where everybody, the mercenaries live. It's, you know, they got their own chef and then Van Gogh paintings hanging on the walls. So it's kind of a fun situation.
So any final thoughts about Isaac Bell and the Assassin?
Because this one, it was on the basis of the oil, you know, what was going on with the oil, Standard Oil, Rockefeller, and the fascination of, you know, him taking over this oil field over in, Russia. And so that's things like that nobody knows about. I mean, it's in the history books, but nobody reads about them. So it was fun to use Rockefeller as, you know, like as he got there, bought out, you know, the oil fields. And then the fact that he wasn't really all as bad as he was made out to be, but and then he became a great philanthropist. And so it's just a fascinating era. You know, besides the detective, Isaac Bell, it's just the era that nobody really, you know, remembers. Young people today don't know anything about the turn of the century or what was going on.
Hmm. Yeah, it really was a great read. Well, Clive, thank you so much for joining us today. And now let's listen to a sampling of The Assassin, Book 8 in the Isaac Bell Adventure Series, performed by Scott Brick.
Remember what I told him? We'll melt your passengers in our refinery, but it's your job to make them solid again. The president of the railroad had granted Spike's joke a thin smile, and their lease a death blow. You can't pay me enough to let your pipe cross my tracks. Why not? Orders straight from the 11th floor. In the year 1899, there was only one 11th floor in the United States of America. Rockefeller's office at Standard Oil's No. 26 Broadway headquarters in New York. And it packed more punch than the White House and Congress combined. Tonight, Bill Matters was punching back. 60 men piled out of the wagons with picks and shovels and tongs and pipe jacks. Working by starlight, they dug a shallow trench across the field and under the trestle. Tong hands wrestled 30-foot-long 8-inch steel pipes off the wagons, propped them on jacks over the trench, and screwed the lengths together. The distant train sounds they had heard earlier suddenly grew loud. Matters saw a glow in the trees and realized too late he had misjudged their distance. They were indeed on this branch line, not far away, but steaming slowly, quietly, one from the north, one from the south. Ditch diggers and tongmen looked up. Headlamps blazed. The monster H-6 Baldwin 280 locomotives burst from the wooded hills and rumbled onto the trestles. "Keep working!" shouted Bill Matters. "We own this land. We got every right. Keep working!" The 90-ton engines thundered overhead and stopped on the trestle, nose to nose, cowcatchers touching directly above Matters and Hopewell's just-laid pipe. One was hauling a flat car crammed with railroad cops, the other a wreck train with a 100-ton crane. The railroad cops shoved the locomotive firemen from their furnaces, threw open the fire doors, and snaked hoses from the locomotive boilers. A giant mounted the front of the wreck train. The glaring headlamps lit a hard, hot-tempered face and a mammoth chest and belly. Matters recognized Big Pete Straub, a towering Standard Oil strikebreaker with a company cop star pinned to his vest, a gun on his hip, and a pick handle in his fist. "Drop your tools!" Straub shouted down at the men in the field. "Stand your ground," yelled Matters. "Back to work." "Run," roared Straub. "Law's on our side. We got every right." "Let 'em have it, boys." The railroad cops scooped burning coals from the furnaces and whirled open steam valves. Fire and boiling water rained down on Matters' workmen. "Stand your ground." Burned and scalded, they fled. Matters intercepted the stampede and waded in with both fists, knocking men down as they tried to get away. Spike grabbed his arm. "Ease off, Bill. Let 'em go. They're outgunned." Matters smashed a ditch digger's ribs and knocked another man cold with a single blow. "Cowards!" A burning coal sailed down from the starry sky, trailing sparks. It set Matters' coat sleeve on fire. Hot coals fanned his cheek. The stink of singed hair seared his nostrils. He jerked his Remington from his coat, ran straight at the trestle, and climbed the pier. Spike charged back into the battle zone and grabbed his boot.
"Are you nuts? Where you going?"
"Kill Straub."
"He's got 20 years on you and 50 armed men. Run!"
Spike Hopewell outweighed Bill Matters. He dragged him off the trestle.
We've just heard The Assassin by Clive Cussler with Justin Scott. God Help the Child is Toni Morrison's first novel set in our current moment. It's an impactful tale about how the sufferings of childhood can shape and misshape the life of the adult. At the center, a young woman who calls herself Bride, whose stunning blue-black skin is only one element of her beauty, but the one that causes her light-skinned mother to deny her even the simplest forms of love. There's Booker, the man Bride loves but loses to anger, and Rain, the mysterious white child with whom she crosses paths. And finally, there is Bride's mother, Sweetness, who takes a lifetime to come to understand that what you do to children matters, and they might never forget. This fierce, provocative novel is performed by the author.
Jerry, calling himself a total person designer, insisted. "Looking for a makeover for my second interview at Sylvia Inc., I consulted him. Not only because of your name," he told me, "but because of what it does to your licorice skin," he said. "And black is the new black, know what I mean? Wait, you're more Hershey syrup than licorice. Makes people think of whipped cream and chocolate souffle every time they see you." That made me laugh. "Or Oreos? Never. Something classy, bonbons, hand-dipped." At first it was boring, shopping for white-only clothes, until I learned how many shades of white there were. Ivory, oyster, alabaster, paper white, snow, cream, ecru, champagne, ghost, bone. Shopping got even more interesting when I began choosing colors for accessories. Jerry, advising me, said, "Listen, Bride baby, if you must, have a drop of color, limited to shoes and purses, but I'd keep both black when white simply won't do. And don't forget, no makeup, not even lipstick or eyeliner, none. I asked him about jewelry, gold, some diamonds, an emerald brooch. No, no, he threw up his hands. No jewelry at all. Pearl dot earrings, maybe. No, not even that, just you, girl. All sable and ice. A panther in snow. And with your body and those wolverine eyes, police. I took his advice, and it worked. Everywhere I went, I got double takes, but not like the faintly disgusted ones I used to get as a kid. These were adoring looks, stunned but hungry. Plus, unbeknownst to him, Jerry had given me the name for a product line, You Girl. My face looks almost new in the mirror. My lips are back to normal, so are my nose and my eye. Only my rib area is still tender. And to my surprise, the scraped skin on my face has healed the quickest.
We've just heard God Help the Child by Toni Morrison. Every 15 Minutes by Lisa Scottoline focuses on Dr. Eric Parrish, chief of psychiatry at a prestigious Philadelphia hospital. His unit at the hospital has just been named number 2 in the country, an achievement Eric credits in large part to his devoted staff of doctors and nurses. Recently separated from his wife, Eric works hard to do his best as a single dad to his 7-year-old daughter. When Eric takes on a new patient, his world begins to crumble. 17-year-old Max has a terminally ill grandmother, and he's having trouble handling that. That, plus his OCD, violent thoughts, and his obsession with a girlfriend, make him a high-risk patient. Max can't turn off the mental rituals that he needs to perform every 15 minutes to keep him calm. With pressure mounting, Max is at the breaking point. When his girlfriend is found murdered, Max goes missing, and Eric sets out to look for him. In doing so, he puts himself in danger of being seen as a person of interest in the case. Next, one of his own staff turns on him in a trumped-up charge of sexual harassment. Is all this chaos random? Or is someone systematically trying to destroy Eric's life? George Newbern narrates.
Does Max have any brothers or sisters? No, he's an only child. He doesn't even have any friends. At home, he never leaves his room except to take care of me or eat dinner, and he plays those computer games all night. I'm all he has. Mrs. Teichner blinked away tears. What's going to happen to him? He could hurt himself after I'm gone. Please, take this. Eric pulled a Kleenex from a box on the bedside table and handed it to her. As a psychiatrist, he spent a lot of time handing people tissues, but it still tore his heart out when women cried, especially older ones. They reminded him of his mother, whom he still thought about every day. I don't know what to do. I'm worried sick about him. Do you really think he'd harm himself? Yes, I really do. Mrs. Teichner dabbed her nose, which came to a curved point. Pinkish mottling on its sides told him her oxygenation was poor, which was to be expected. He's an odd duck, but he's a good kid, with a good heart. Has he ever tried to hurt himself, or said words to that effect? No, he doesn't talk about himself or his feelings. His father was the same way. That good-for-nothing. Eric let it go. Has Max gone to a therapist or gotten counseling at school? No, he's embarrassed. He says he'll get teased if people find out. Mrs. Teichner sniffled, wiping her nose. I'm beside myself. I pray on it all the time. It's just so hard. I've asked around, but nobody comes through. Please, help him. Well, I do have a private practice, Eric found himself saying, though he hardly needed a new client. I could make time to see him if he wanted.
Really?
Mrs. Teichner's hooded eyes rounded with hope.
Would you?
I would if he wants to come.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Eric's heart eased to see her relieved. But you have to understand that psychotherapy is a serious undertaking, and you've probably heard that it helps only if the person really wants to do it. I'll make the offer to Max, but it's up to him.
He'll go, I know. You've lifted such a load off.
Mrs. Teichner clapped her arthritic hands together, holding her Kleenex.
Really, there's nothing on earth that matters to me as much as that boy. I can be at peace if I know he's okay. You understand if you have kids.
I do. Eric thought of Hannah, but kept that to himself. His daughter was only 7 years old, and he worried about what would happen to her if he wasn't around. Since his separation from his wife, that worry had become more than academic.
And, Doc, I can pay you. Don't worry about it. What does it cost to see you? $50 or $60 an hour?
About that, yes, Eric answered. His fee was $300 an hour, and for clients who couldn't afford that, he had a sliding scale that was never less than $250, except for crying old ladies facing terminal diagnoses. Psychiatry was among the lowest-paying medical specialties because it required virtually no procedures, with the highest fees generated by procedure-heavy practices like orthopedics, with its hip replacements and Tommy John surgeries, or plastic surgery with its facelifts, nose jobs, and boob jobs. Every psychiatrist hated the irony that the best-paying specialty was cosmetic surgery, as if you could fix your psyche by changing your face.
Then it's a deal. Thank you so much.
Happy to help. Eric rose, brushing down his khakis. Before I leave, are you sure you don't want to talk to me about yourself? I've treated patients coping with a diagnosis like yours, and it's understandable if you want some help.
Nah, I'm a tough cookie. Except for the cancer. I'm fine.
Mrs. Teichner waved him off with an ironic smile. Virginia, it was a pleasure meeting you. Eric slid his wallet from his pocket, extracted a card, and set it down on the bedside table. If you change your mind, feel free to call me. Don't hesitate. You are one tough cookie.
You bet your ass,
Mrs. Teichner shot back. Eric smiled, trying not to wonder if he would see her alive again. He gave her a final wave and motioned to the medical students to leave. Mrs. Teichner, bye now. I'll send Dr. Fortunato in. Best of luck.
That was a sampling of Every 15 Minutes by Lisa Scottoline. Legend and Lies, The Real West is Bill O'Reilly's entertaining look at the truth behind the Western legends we all think we know. How did Davy Crockett save President Jackson's life only to end up dying at the Alamo? Was the Lone Ranger based on a real lawman, and was he an African American? Did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid really die in a hail of bullets in South America? We've grown up on TV shows, movies, and books about these Western icons. But what really happened in the Wild West? O'Reilly, writing with David Fisher, focuses on legends like Kit Carson, Jesse James, Wild Bill Hickok, Daniel Boone, Buffalo Bill, and Annie Oakley. Tom Wopat performs the book.
The 24-year-old Hickok had been driving freight wagons and coaches along the Santa Fe Trail for Russell, Majors, and Waddell, the parent company of the Pony Express, until he got into a tussle with a bear. When his shot ricocheted off the bear's head, Hickok wrestled it and cut its throat. But not before that bear inflicted some serious damage. While recuperating, Hickok did odd jobs at the relay station, tending to horses and wagons, for station manager Horace Wellman. Hickok lived with Wellman and Wellman's wife, Jane, in the station's small cabin, which had been built on land Wellman purchased from a local rancher named David C. McCandless. McCandless was an ornery fellow who insisted on derisively calling Hickok Duck Bill, supposedly a reference to his large, narrow nose and protruding lips, and another name that didn't stick. Naturally, being made fun of did not sit well with Hickok. One day, McCandless showed up at the station with his son, Monroe, and two members of his gang, demanding his land back because Wellman was late on his payments. But once again, another version of the story says that the real reason McCandless showed up concerned the affections of a young woman who had taken a liking to Hickok. McCandless stood outside the cabin and began haranguing Hickok and the Wellmans, possibly ordering them off his land. A blanket had been hung inside the cabin, most likely to provide some privacy, and both Hickok and Wellman stepped behind it. One of them, it never was quite clear which, took a Hawken rifle off the wall and fired once through the blanket into McCandless's chest. He fell dead on the ground. McCandless's men, James Woods and James Roberts, went for their guns. Woods rushed the cabin, but Hickok pulled his Colt and wounded him, allowing Jane Wellman to finish him off with her sharpened garden hoe. Hickok fired again through the door, this time hitting Roberts, who stumbled off into the woods. Hickok pursued him and came out alone. Monroe McCandless ran off untouched. Civilization was coming to the West, and three dead men now required a legal hearing. 4 days after the shootout, Hickok and Horace Wellman were on trial. McCandless had come to Nebraska from North Carolina, so in addition to being a bully, he was thought to be pro-Confederate. Wellman and Hickok claimed they had been defending company property, and the circuit judge agreed with them. But as soon as the verdict was rendered, Hickok packed his saddlebags and left Rock Creek to join the war. The first battle of the Civil War, First Bull Run, had just begun at Manassas, Virginia. By 1867, stories of derring do in the West were thrilling readers in the big cities. In February of that year, journalist George Ward Nichols published a long illustrated article entitled Wild Bill in the popular Harper's New Monthly magazine. In this wildly exaggerated article, McCandless shows up at the station with his gang of reckless, bloodthirsty devils who would fight as long as they had the strength to pull the trigger.
We've just heard Legends and Lies, The Real West by Bill O'Reilly with David Fisher. Lieutenant Eve Dallas walks the thin line between love and hate in Obsession and Death, the 40th thriller from J.D. Robb, a pen name of Nora Roberts. Eve Dallas has solved a lot of high-profile murders for the NYPSD and gotten a lot of media. She and her billionaire husband are getting accustomed to being objects of attention, gossip, and speculation. But now Eve has become the object of one person's obsession. Someone who thinks about her every hour of the day, who believes the two of them have a special bond, who would kill for her again and again. With a murderer reading meanings into her every move, handling this case will be dangerous. And Eve knows that underneath the admiration, a terrible threat lies in wait. Because Eve is not grateful for the bloody offerings from her true and loyal friend. And in time, idols always fall. Susan Erickson narrates.
On a cold, crisp morning in the waning days of 2060, Lieutenant Eve Dallas stood in a sumptuous bedroom done in bold strokes of rich purple, deep metallic grays, and quick splashes of green. Outside, the ad blimps manically touted the after-Christmas blowout sales, and street vendors hyped fake designer wrist units and knock-off handbags to throngs of tourists packed into the city for the holiday week. Outside, life went on. Inside the plush bedroom with all its color and style, it had stopped. An enormous arrangement of white lilies and purple roses in a tall mirrored vase on the pedestal, centered in the wide window, couldn't quite mask the smell of death. Instead, the fragrance layered over it, sickly sweet. On a bed big enough for six, lay the body of a woman who'd once been a stunner. Even now, her meticulous style showed in the perfect coordination of silver lounging pants, silky lavender top, the perfectly manicured nails, hands and feet, with polish of dark purple on all 10 digits. Her heavily lashed eyes stared straight up to the ceiling, as if mildly puzzled. A razor-thin, bone-deep wound circled her throat. Blood, now congealed, had spilled from that ugly curve to soil and spoil the soft gray bedding and mat in the fall of pale blonde hair. Her tongue sat in a faceted glass dish on the glossy nightstand beside the bed. But the kicker, at least for Eve, was the message written on the wall above the thickly padded headboard in precise block lettering, black against the gray. For Lieutenant Eve Dallas, with great admiration and understanding. Her life was a lie. Her death, our truth. She showed you no respect, spoke ill of you, sought to profit by undermining all you work for. It was my pleasure and honor to balance the scales. Justice has been served. Your true and loyal friend. Beside Eve, her partner, Detective Peabody, blew out a long breath. Holy Dallas. Whether or not Eve thought the same, she turned to the uniformed officer in the bedroom doorway. Who found her? Her radman. The Vic missed the dinner meeting last night, then didn't come into work where she had a morning meeting. So the admin, Cecil Haversham, came by. Nobody could reach her via link. She didn't answer the door. He had her codes and key pass. Stated he waters her plants and whatnot when she's out of town. Let himself in at about 9:15, heard the bedroom screen on like it is now, and walked through until he found her. We got the 911 at 9:19, so the timing works. Where is he? Place has a dining area you can close off. We're sitting on him there. Keep sitting. I want the building security disks, exterior, interior, and I want a canvas started, beginning with this floor. Yes, sir.
That was Obsession and Death by Nora Roberts. Holy Cow, a modern-day dairy tale, is a rollicking, globe-trotting adventure with a four-legged heroine you won't soon forget. The author is David Duchovny, yes, star of The X-Files. Though he is a new author, I believe his fame makes him totally appropriate for this show. Elsie Bovary is a cow, and a happy one at that. Her long, lazy days are spent eating, napping, and chatting with her best friend, Mallory. One night, Elsie and Mallory sneak out of their pasture. But while Mallory flirts with neighboring bulls, Elsie finds herself drawn to the farmhouse. Through the window, she sees the farmer's family gathered around a bright box god. And what the box god reveals about something called an industrial meat farm shakes Elsie's world to its core. There's only one solution: escape to a better, safer world. And so a motley crew is formed. Elsie, Jerry, otherwise known as Shalom, a cranky Torah-reading pig who's recently converted to Judaism, and Tom, a suave turkey who can't fly but who can work an iPhone with his beak. Toting stolen passports and slapdash human disguises, they head for the airport. Elsie is our wisecracking, pop culture reference-dropping, slyly witty narrator. Tom dispenses psychiatric advice in a fake German accent, and Shalom, rejected by his adopted people in Jerusalem, ends up unexpectedly uniting Israelis and Palestinians. Duchovny's charismatic creatures point the way toward a mutual understanding and acceptance that our world desperately needs. The author narrates.
You like that? My editor told me if I add some sex, curses, and maybe some potty humor, this will sell better to my audience. I don't know who my audience is. I want everybody to hear the story. But my editor says human adults won't take a talking animal seriously. Why not? I asked. What about Animal Farm and Charlotte's Web? Babe. And she goes, Elsie, 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 times have changed. And anyway, this isn't an allegory. This is a true story, blah, 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 blah. So she's going to market it as a kid's book, a wolf in sheep's clothing, which is fine by me. I like kids. But then she says, adults are going to read this book to their kids, so you have to sprinkle little inside jokes along the way with some allusions to pop culture from the last 30 years so they don't get too bored. Just make sure you make a reference to Gilligan's Island or Star Wars or Depeche Mode or Chia Pets or something. Cover the decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, aughts, and the occasional penis joke. She gave me a bunch of movies to look at to see what she was talking about, but they kind of bored me, to be honest. Like they were trying to talk out of both sides of the mouth. But I guess I get what she means. There should be a wink now and then. That's okay. So some of my readers know what's supposed to happen when we get up there with the bulls. You know, cue the funky bass line and the bad acting. That's another thing. Humans are so weird about the sex. It's like pooping, folks. Everybody does it. That's my next book, The Educated Flea. But don't worry. This is a PG story. Wink, wink. Hey, man, don't hate the player. Hate the game. My editor also told me my story should be written more like a screenplay than a book, because that's where the big audience is. Not books anymore, but movies. So that's what I've been attempting wherever possible. And she says animated movies are the biggest movies of all, and that animals are often the stars of animated films. I say, how can I write it like a movie if it's a true story? And she literally jumps out of her chair and says, Goldmine, the first animated documentary, Goldmine. Just write out the dialogue without quotes and underneath the character's name, and they'll think it's a documentary screenplay, and it will make it longer to boot. And remember to put something in like, the names have been changed to protect them, you know, blah, blah, blah. We'll see if Hollywood calls. I'll have to lose some weight. I'm as big as a yak. I also have some very specific casting ideas about who should play me. But my editor says if I put them out there, it will step on the toes of the producers. She says producers like to think everything is their idea. So I'll hold my tongue on the casting. Jennifer Lawrence. Anyway, I have to admit the sound the bulls were making was a bit mesmerizing. We were drawn to it, Mallory and me. It was like the sweetest music. Sounds that had been stupid to us the day before were now like the Beatles. Pop culture reference. Check. Weird. I don't get it. But it's natural. Happens to us all. We were making our way up to the bulls, and the bulls now knew we were heading their way, and boy, oh boy, did they start to get pumped up, snorting louder and pawing the ground and showing off by running and smashing into one another. Mallory and I were pretty jazzed that they were putting on this whole big show for us. Made us feel like a couple of special cows. Made us feel pretty and bullish. You're welcome. When we got up to the fence, the bulls were like, hey there, baby girl, and what's up? Trying to be cool, and it was then I realized, yeah, we got outside our gate, but we didn't think about the bulls' gate. Mallory realized this is the exact moment I did, because we're BFFs, and we both said, oh no, how do we get this gate open? Now, to be totally honest with you, I was somewhat relieved. I didn't feel I was totally ready to enjoy the company of a bull without a nice sturdy fence between us, but I couldn't really tell Mallory that. The bulls were freaking me out a little this close-up. Weird energy, if you know what I'm saying. The bulls are now like, you want me to knock down this fence, little lady? Because I totally will. I will knock this down. And similar type stuff. And Mallory's just grinning away like a moron. So I say, let me go find something I can smash the latch with. Something heavy. And Mallory is like a zombie at this point. She's like, sure, 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 whatevs. And I'm like, what happened to cows before bulls and before bros, but really, I get it. I do. And I love her to death.
That was a sampling of Holy Cow by David Duchovny. What a great group of books. And with summer just ahead, there's a slew of titles coming out soon, like Finders Keepers from Stephen King and The Wright Brothers, new from David McCullough. You can be sure we'll be previewing all the top titles as soon as they are released. Keep current by checking my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.